It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. This is one of my favorite shows. Is our Thanksgiving Chatter family special. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking a lot with a multi-talented, disgustingly multi-talented guy named Bob Brush, who has a wonderful book called, we'll talk about his career, but we want to talk mostly about this book, The Piazza, which is unlike anything I've ever read, unlike anything we've ever done on Chatter. It is a wonderful litany of stories of people whose lives interact in the most interesting ways in a time and place that might exist, might not have existed, but it is absolutely lovely. And it's got beautiful illustrations as well. So we want to talk about that. But first, award-winning Clyde Jennings is running our show tonight. He's disappeared for a little bit, which always makes me a little bit nervous. And two of my absolute favorite people are back with us. Nevin Martell, Nevin, I can't remember how you and I first met, but you know so much about food, about travel, about photography, about being a dad, about restaurants. It is so great to have you back.
It wouldn't be Thanksgiving unless I was spending today with you.
Exactly.
This is the greatest of traditions.
We'll never think of smelly turkeys, you know. On any other side.
How, that's a flashback right there.
And Rodney Ferguson, who, as I said earlier, is my favorite foundation head by day, celebrity mixologist by night. And we'll have to talk soon about the custom cocktail he's made for this evening. But you guys, welcome back. Thanks for being with us. I have so many things I want to talk to you guys about and ask you about, but we have to talk about Twitter.
Yes.
And Nevin, I'm going to go to you first. And then Rodney, I have thoughts. I have concerns.
So many thoughts.
Never do enough to promote this wonderful show. And Twitter is probably the primary place right now, but I have thoughts and concerns. And I can't see myself and or this show staying on Twitter for much longer. But Nevin, you first, because you've gone off, right?
Yeah, so I've put my account on hold. I haven't begun the deactivation process, but, you know, I posted and pinned a tweet about staying off the platform, and my handle name reflects that now. And I'm really pouring my efforts into Instagram and to a lesser degree to Facebook. It just seems like it is turning into a flaming dumpster fire, and I don't want to be any part of that. And to be honest, you know, I have like close to 9,000 followers, and it was a great promotion platform for me, but it also was a huge time suck. And for all the times, you know, I did get something out of it in terms of readers looking at my stories or people buying tickets to events that I was a part of, there were so many times that I sent tweets that you just disappeared into the ether and took time out of my life that I'll never get back. And, you know, I think at this point, it's just not, it's not the greatest of platforms. It's just not a public square that I feel like I need to be a part of. But I don't want to give up my handle yet, not because I'm worried that there are all these people waiting in the wings to take at Nevin Martell, but just in case somehow it turns around. And, you know, I would hate to have like spent all that time building up that following only to, you know, just toss it into that dumpster fire. But for the meantime, for the foreseeable future, I'm just not going to be on the platform.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you. Rodney, what about you? And if you can't, again, whenever you don't want to talk about work, just tell me you don't want to talk about work. Because in your other field, people have a huge amount of respect for you. But professionally and personally, where are you on Twitter these days?
Well, I've gotten off as of a couple weeks ago. And, you know, Nevin, to your point, at least you can roast marshmallows on a dumpster fire. You know, I don't think I would even warm my hands against this dumpster fire. I mean, it's stunning. I mean, you know, let us count the ways as to why we would leave, right? It's now becoming ever more toxic as a platform in terms of your fellow travelers on that platform. The stunning and rapid incompetence. I mean, it sounds counterintuitive to talk about Elon Musk as being incompetent because the guy's built a car, a hugely successful electric car company. He's sending cargo into outer space. He may send the first rocket to the moon. But it's, you know, it reminds me that, you know, you can't assume if you're brilliant at X, you're going to be brilliant at Y. You know, brilliance is not omnipotent. And this is stunning how he has destroyed this platform in, and I can say the last thing I'll say, because I could talk about this forever.
Yeah.
I had to get off for nothing else than his, we're going to double down and make you work 24 hours a day.
Oh, God.
One of my employees would have, you know, roasted me if any way we did anything to endorse that, because this is not the age in which you're telling people to give up on family, friends, you know, their mental health, everything, to work around the clock for what? For him? Yeah. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah. I can accept the incompetence because I are incompetent, right? I can accept that incompetence. I take your point, Ronnie. People, just because they're good at this doesn't mean they're good at that. But again, you know, the number of things, you know, the mandates he sent out once he took over Twitter, and then 2 days later he go, oh, not really.
Right.
Whatever. Yeah. But it's his own personal tweets. I mean, first of all, it's what he allows to happen and the kinds of people he allows to say the kinds of things they say on Twitter. But then his own personal tweets are horrifying.
Yeah, they're horrifying. I didn't even get the time to mention that one. That's just one of the many areas that would get you off of Twitter.
Yeah. Okay. Now I think I know what I'm going to do. Won't do it tonight, but I think I know what I'm going to do. I like the idea of a pause, Nevin. But before I stop ranting, I promise we'll talk about books here. Right now, Bob Brush is watching this going, what show am I on?
What did I sign up for? I thought this was like a happy-go-lucky show.
As we always say, this show, Claude knows this, this show plagiarizes liberally from PTI, from Tony Kornheiser's show, his podcast, and from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And as Tony's show, which is how I first started this whole thing, was ostensibly about sports, but a lot of other things. Mm. This is ostensibly about books, but it's about a lot of other things. So earlier this afternoon, my husband, two of my sons, one of my son's wonderful girlfriends, and another friend of theirs, met at a bar a few blocks away to watch the U.S. men play Wales in the first round, in the first group of. Yeah, don't get all excited, Nevin. I was rooting for Wales.
Why?
Because for the last 10 days, every time I turn around, there was some multi-million-dollar ad campaign supporting the U.S. men's team. Mm-hmm. You got Ted Lasso. I'm never going to watch the next season of Ted Lasso. Doing great things to promote the U.S. men's team, who, by the way, have lost again and again and again and again. Versus, did you ever see a multi-million-dollar ad campaign riding on you know, for the U.S. women who have won repeatedly?
So true. Repeatedly? So true.
And then if that doesn't get my blood boiling enough, just that it's in Qatar. I hope Patty's watching. Maybe she can tell us wherever, however you pronounce it, which was the whole tournament is the World Cup is built literally on the backs of people who were killed, died making the stadiums, working in incredibly horrible conditions. And then I was kind of thinking to myself earlier today, okay, I'm going to suck it up because I love spending time with my family. I won't wear a jersey, but I will go with them. Yep. And then I see where the FIFA officials, who, by the way, the rant's over in about 30 seconds here, the FIFA officials who can drink, because they're special VIP suites, and they have alcohol. Nobody else can, but they can drink. The FIFA officials decided that the England men's team wanted to wear rainbow bands, right, in support of LGBTQ+. And they were told, not you'll get a penalty, not you'll get a fine. They were told you'll get a yellow card if you wear one of those on the field. So enough. If any of you want to defend the World Cup or the U.S. men's team, go right ahead.
And there's only one solution here. That's put Elon Musk in charge of FIFA.
Oh my God! So there won't be another World Cup, is what you're saying? It's just going to drive that into the ground too.
Oh God!
Yeah, man.
Yeah. I told my wife this morning, Tori, that we didn't even mention specifically the beer ban 2 days ago.
Yeah,
3 days ago. This has been planned for years.
Yeah,
I don't know if you knew.
15, didn't they get the? You know, didn't they pay for and bribe everybody to get the?
Oh sure, of course. And you may or may not know, but in a previous life, I spent a lot of time in Qatar, a lot.
Yeah.
And I can tell you this beer ban timing was planned 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
This has been completely choreographed.
Sure.
Canceled the beer sales 2 or 3 days out before giving no one time to do anything about it. Now, look, I mean, I'm not going to go to the mat over beer, but it's just indicative of the whole spirit of if not FIFA, these particular games, it's gotten off to a horrible start.
Horrible. Yeah.
They signed contracts years ago saying they would abide by all the rules and regulations affecting the giant sponsors, including Budweiser. And then days out, they do this.
Yeah.
Okay, Rodney, give us a quick positive travelogue of Hanoi, Kathmandu, and Dakar, where you have been.
Well, three wonderful places. But I just got back a couple of days ago from Hanoi, picked up a nasty upper respiratory infection, but I'm better, thank God. But I was in Kathmandu and then flew from Kathmandu to Hanoi. Kathmandu is a wonderful, fascinating place, but it's sort of a mess. And because it hasn't really recovered from the 2016, I think, earthquake. And they're trying. They're making progress. We have a lot of programming there, and their people are wonderful. And, it's a warm, wonderful country. Hanoi is one of the most interesting places I travel. If you go to Vietnam, there are a couple of things striking you. It's the youngest country you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Everyone is young.
Yeah.
Everyone. And there's so much energy. There's so much entrepreneurialism, which sounds like a oxymoron, given that it is still essentially a communist country. But I think we've seen today's communism is not your grandfather's Karl Marx, right? It's a much different thing. And there's so much entrepreneurialism, energy, vibrancy. I love going there. We just launched a wonderful program to help reduce environmental pollution in the country. And I love going there. They've got some challenges. Pollution is a huge problem. And we hope to help on the margins with that, or maybe beyond the margins. It's a dynamic place. I really like going there.
Yeah.
And we have a lot going on. My organization has a lot going on there. So, and then Dakar last, I'll be quick. Dakar is also a fascinating place, a lot like Hanoi in that regard. Very young, very dynamic. A lot of entrepreneurs were actually running a program there that's to promote entrepreneurialism. That's among other programs. We have four different programs running there. And I just love the Senegalese people. They're warm. They're French without the snootiness. They're also, and I mean, I know we're not supposed to talk about this because I can be accused of looksism. They're the most beautiful people in the world. They're this really beautiful, and there's this great thing going on. The hobby among young Senegalese men, in Dakar at least, is they go to the beach every night at sort of sunset or dusk, and they work out in huge groups, like 200 people. And some of them are doing sprints, and it's all plyometric stuff, right? And then there's 50 doing squats.
Can I speak for your lovely better half, Maria, saying she would love that? Maria is just a rock star in so many ways. So she works out and appreciates people who works out, and she appreciates good looking men. So she would really.
Of course. Well, thank you, Tori, but I'm not among that set, but it's remarkable. It's just a remarkable thing to watch. And again, you go to countries and you get a feeling this country's either coming up, stagnant, or going the other way. And and you definitely get a feeling in Dakar and Senegal that this is a country on the rise. And and a lot of American companies are noticing, European companies, and I think the future there is very bright. So it was a great trip.
Very cool. I've been to Dakar, been to Hanoi a couple of times, and another time when we have more time, I will tell the story about 1990. My then boyfriend, Brian Graham, and I went to Vietnam on a lark, and we were detained by the communist government for 5 days.
Ooh.
Allowed to stay in a government guest house, as they called it. But Nevin, I was thinking of you when Rodney was telling me about his travels. I was thinking about you because you're so into food and culture and visuals. Hanoi is just stunning. Absolutely stunning.
It's on the list.
Insane. The food is insane. Should we do some book stuff?
Books. Is that what we're here to talk about?
Books.
Bob is like, yes, we're here to talk about books.
Okay, Claude,
come on.
At the end of the show, make me do the Rob Dundon thing, okay?
Yes, I will.
Okay, so we're putting that over here, but let's do this. Okay, I don't know how this popped up on my stuff, but it did. The Brooklyn Library, which is an incredible library, and if you're going to New York and you're looking for things to do, it is a great place to visit. They recently announced the number one borrowed book ever, and it totally shocked me. I assumed it would be the Bible or something like that. It's Where the Wild Things Are, which is so fabulous. Isn't it? Doesn't that make you feel better?
that the world is a better place now that I know that.
It wasn't how to build a nuclear bomb. It was where the wild things are, which I think is so great.
Oh.
So great. Rodney, did you go to public library in Birmingham when you were a kid?
I remember, Tori, Birmingham was the bright, shining metropolis.
Right.
I grew up in the bustling town of Arab, Alabama. Arab, that's
right. How could I forget?
A-R-A-B, pronounced A long A, Rab, not Arab. And then we moved to Huntsville, and I went to college in Birmingham. So we sort of covered that.
Right.
Yes, yeah. I did. And my favorite thing in the world was to go to the little tiny, dinky Arab Public Library in the downtown, just off Main Street. We had a street off of Main Street on a rainy Saturday. And that was sort of my treat. I would get to go on a Saturday, and I could, and my mom would drop me off what she did errands because we knew the library and you knew everybody, right? And that was pre-paranoid days. And you could drop a kid off at a library and not worry about it. And I would read books, and I would get my three or four or five books, and then a couple hours later, my mom would pick me up. Those are some of my best memories of childhood, actually.
You know, my mom used to tell me that she dropped me off at the local public library, same thing, right off the main drag, town of 3,000 people, so she could do errands. I think I figured out some years later, and I completely endorse what this is, doing errands was meeting her friends for a glass of wine somewhere.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what
raising you, she probably needed it, Tori. Oh, I mean, come on, to be fair.
Five girls, Nevin. She raised five girls. Okay, Nevin, public library in your life as a child?
The Clinton Public Library in Clinton, New York. Beautiful brick, you know, looks like a old church, and awesome staff. I still go there every time I go home and get books out. And, lots of cozy little nooks to find yourself hidden away in. Or when you're on deadline, like I often am when I'm at home, somewhere to go sit and work where family members and random people you went to high school with that you haven't seen in 25 years can't bother you. So,
when you were, say, 10 years old, what would you check out? What would you read?
Man, 10 years old. So my favorite books in that era would have been My Side of the Mountain.
Good one.
And Swiss Family Robinson.
Excellent.
And The Count of Monte Cristo were probably my three favorite in that era.
Excellent ones.
Still books that resonate with me. And certainly they all had deeper lessons that I carry with me.
Do you still pick them up? I find books that I read as a child, I must have read Black Beauty 500 times in the library, but I still pick it up occasionally now and go, okay, great life lessons.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, I just reread My Side of the Mountain to my son, and we're going to read The Count of Monte Cristo coming up right after we have Swiss Family Robinson and Treasure Island in the queue. So we're doing like the old, like, you know, classics, old school classics.
Yeah. We tried to do the classics in movies with our children. We decided they were Sunday nights was going to be classic night. Rodney shaking his head. Yes, he knows our wonderful hoodlum children. And like maybe the third one was Casablanca, and they just revolted.
It's
like 8 and 10 year olds. They just revolted and said, no,
you should have done like Gremlins or Home Alone. Casablanca, a bridge too far right there.
Okay, that gets to the definition of classics, which we could get into, but we won't.
We won't argue about it. We all know Gremlins is a classic. We're not going to argue at that point. Yeah.
Okay, Rodney, this is the next space is yours, because this also popped up on my stuff recently. Men's book clubs. Right. I kind of vaguely knew that they existed. Again, women's books clubs, an excuse to drink. Men's books clubs popped up recently. Might have been on the Today Show or something like that. And Nevin, yell if you're in a men's book club, but Rodney is one of the few people I know who's in a male book club, and he happens to be in it with another friend of mine, which I found out accidentally, Anki Barnes. But come on, Rodney, how long? What's it like? Do you ever read anything by other than male authors?
Well, as a matter of fact, Tori, we read a wide variety of books by all manner of authors. In fact, the book we just read and we'll be discussing next week at our meeting is Horse. Knowing your Black Beauty, you're one of the horses, you're an equestrian. Am I getting the French right? It's not equestrian, you're an equestrian.
Yeah.
And we read Horse by Geraldine Brooks, which was a fantastic book. I highly recommend it. So we read books by men, women. We've read transgender authors and African-American authors. We took a big dive into books about race in America after the George Floyd horror. And so, yeah, I've been in it for 7 years.
Wow.
We call it the Boys Book Club or BBC.
Nice.
And it's, as you know, Anki Barnes, our mutual friend, he was ostensibly the founder of said book club. And I'm 7 years. I'm a relative newcomer. I think it's been around 12, 13 years.
Wow.
Growing. We just added a couple of folks, and it's one of the joys of my life. I love it, and I look forward to going and discussing books. And you know, do we drink? Yes. Do we drink to excess? Only when we read a really bad book.
Yeah.
Then right. you have to hit the bottle a little harder. But it's a wonderful group of guys, and it's a wonderful experience.
What would you do if a girl said she wanted to join?
You're on the record.
I can't speak for the group. And, you know, Anki is first among equals as sort of the founder of the book club. So I don't know. But I honestly think we would probably say there should be in a free and open society, different spaces for different purposes. And this is an enclave, a safe space, if we want to use millennial language, for men. To talk about, I mean, we talk about our feelings. Maybe we want to cry openly, you know, maybe we want to hug, or what's the thing that as millennials like do now, the cuddle groups. Maybe we want to do cuddle groups, and we want to do those without any untowardness at all. So I don't know, but I don't know what we would do, but it's not a request we get very often.
But fun to anticipate. Okay. We're going to skip. Segment B. I think I know where they meet, Claude. I think I know where I could find them. Right?
Are you gonna crash it? Is that what you said?
Yeah. We rotate. For that very reason, we stay one step ahead of the wall.
Oh, wow.
We rotate the spaces.
Man, you're like a carousel.
Remember in the post 9/11 days, they used to ship off the so-called senior officials to undisclosed locations?
Yeah.
Okay, pop quiz, Rodney and Nevin. How many books does the average person read? And we're going to keep this U.S.
Is this men or women in the U.S. or elsewhere?
Men and women, and however they define themselves, in the United States. And this is according to Pew Research.
Per year?
Is this per year?
Yeah, per year. How many books does the average person in the United States read per year?
This is one of those questions that's going to tell you a lot about your view of humanity. And the United States, right? So if I say 40, it's going to
be. You're wrong. I'm going to say six.
I'm saying five. Not to Price is Right you, but I say five.
Okay. So it's like who comes closest without going over. So according to Pew, they did a study in 2016. So think about that, several years ago. 72% of Americans had read a book the preceding year. That number went up to 75% in 2022. I thought that increase would have been more given the pandemic and everything else. The 2016 publication showed that on average, Americans read 12 books a year, but now they're doing median, right? Because it's just really hard to say averages. It doesn't really work that well. So now they're doing it the median numbers, which is better. So the median for 2016 was that the American reader reads 4 books each year. Wow. So are you feeling better? Okay, Nevin, how many books a year do you read?
I read a couple dozen. You know, I only get a chance to read in the morning before my family's up on vacation. And when I'm traveling, you know, like when I'm on a plane or a train or a bus. So if I can knock out 2 books a month, aside from all the reading I do for work, that's a good month for me.
When our kids, your son is young, or when our kids were young, I never read anything.
Yeah, no, I only started a couple years ago.
I couldn't even read the stuff that I was supposed to read for work. I would look at it and assess it for what do I have to do with this and then move it to somebody else, hopefully. Rodney, how many books a year?
I would say, like Nevin, probably 20. But I probably read 20 cover to cover. I probably read 30 or 40 partial books. Mm. Mm. And I know that's a controversial idea, but
that counts.
You know, where you might read, and frankly, a lot of the books I start and I really like, my life's too short, right? I'm not going to get hung up on a completion fetish. I just don't like this book. I'm not going to finish it.
No, that's good. And life's too short. to finish.
I'm with Rodney. It took me a long time to get to the point, though, where I was willing to let go of a book, even after I realized I didn't like it or I didn't believe in it anymore.
Right.
I think that's a real sign of maturity as a reader.
Yeah, so. You were too conscientious before. Okay, yeah. Bob Brush, multi-talented person. You still awake? You still want to join us?
I'm here and I'm fascinated.
How many books a year do you read?
Well, I'm like Rodney. I begin an awful large number of books, but I get disappointed pretty quickly. And I also find that when I'm really writing, I can't read because anything that I read threatens whatever I'm doing.
Yeah.
Because it might be better than what I'm doing, or it might, you know, in some kind of way, or a character may start sending me off in the wrong direction. And then I realize that that my latest novel is a total sham and that I should never have begun it. And so I try to avoid that kind of thing. So I guess I only look for bad books and then I'm disappointed with them when I read them. So the answer is
such a fatalist reader. I love it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, Bob, I've done a lot of reading about you, and a lot of what I've learned is on Wikipedia, so I'll share it carefully. But tell us, give us the backstory. Where are you from? Where did you grow up? What did you want to be when you were five? And the multi-talentedness of your life is just really, it's inspiring, and it's also just discouraging. But where are you from? Where did you grow up? What did you want to be?
I'm a kid from the suburbs of northern New Jersey.
Wow, which one?
Bergen County, New Jersey.
Sure, yeah.
And I, you know, I grew up with that life. I played as a kid, I played in rock and roll bands and folk singing groups and played baseball and wanted to be Willie Mays. I still would like to be Willie Mays, but the clock is running out on me, I think.
Yeah.
And after college, I moved into New York and I lived right down the block from Norman Mailer and Truman Capote. So I was all set at 21 to take my place in the pantheon of.
Did you know they were there? Did you see them?
I did.
On the street?
Norman. I had a little picture window on looked out on Henry Street in Brooklyn Heights, and Norman Mailer would walk by. And one day he actually looked up and saw me in the window, and I gave him the finger. Because I thought that was the appropriate thing to do with Norman Mailer.
And how did he respond?
His response?
He had that look on his face of whatever that was that just happened, I don't need this. So he kept going. So my idea was that I always wanted to be, I had played music. I played cocktail piano. And from the time I was a 14-year-old and I was did a lot of composing. And I wanted to mix those two because I'm of the mind that language is music. Uh-huh. So I was going to do that, but instead I got a job writing children's television, and I wrote for Captain Kangaroo. And
okay, can we stop there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Captain Kangaroo is one of the most important people in my life.
There you go.
Mr. Green Jeans. Yeah. Are you kidding?
Mr. Green Jeans. Bunny Rabbit.
Lumpy Branham was Mr. Green Jeans' name.
Wow. Okay, wait. Again, let's go back to my mother raising five girls. I was the youngest of five girls. And by the time they got to me, there was just sheer exhaustion, right? So it was like, whatever we can do.
I understand. I have two daughters, and I understand that.
God bless you. God bless you. So that started, that was my North Star. I learned because my parents had given up trying to teach anybody anything. There were no life lessons. There's no, right?
Right.
So Captain Kangaroo was where I learned, you know, how to deal in life. Was so spectacular. I want to know what he was like. And one of my sisters had a theory. Do you remember Dancing Bear?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I wrote a lot of music for Dancing Bear, and I wrote these things called little operettas that were little musicals. One which is a story about how Dancing Bear became a star. And
screw your book, Bob. We're just going to talk.
Yeah, let's talk about
it. One of my sisters had a theory that Dancing Bear was actually a woman, that the person inside Dancing Bear was a woman. No. Can you confirm or deny that?
No, Dancing Bear was the same person as was Mr. Moose and Bunny Rabbit and Grandfather Clock. A lovely guy named Gus. I actually believe his name was Quinticento Allegretti.
Wow.
Who was just this wonderful guy who also had minor roles in a lot of Scorsese type gangster flicks because he absolutely looked like a hardened criminal. But so yeah. he was all of those characters.
As a small child, I found Grandfather Clock a little creepy. There was something
you know, a little creepy. My sister did that too. When she was watching.
So you think you're going to be composing spectacular music and writing great things, and you're writing Captain Kangaroo, but that's the start. Then what?
That's the start. And but at the whole time, I was also interested in, I thought, in Broadway musicals. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of going along that path. And I wrote a couple of musicals that kind of didn't go anywhere. And then I met Martin Charnin, the guy who created and directed and produced Annie.
Wow.
And and he heard my music and said, we're going to do a musical together. And I said, that's great. And we went one day for breakfast, and he handed me a book and said, this is the musical we're going to do. And Joel Siegel, if you remember Joel Siegel, who was a music critic on CBS, I think, is going to write the book. And I opened it, and it was the Jackie Robinson story. And I said, wait a minute, the kid from New Jersey and the two Jews from New York are going to write a musical about Jackie Robinson? But we did. And it was, it lasted, you know, it lasted a couple of months to some horrendous reviews. And that convinced me I didn't need to do that anymore. So I moved to, I went out to LA and got work, write if you get work, writing with a fellow named Jay Tarsis, who we did The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, which I still have very great fondness for.
Terrific show.
And the Slap Maxwell story. And that led me to take over the Wonder Years halfway through its first season.
Just a little show.
Little show.
Yeah. And that was great. I loved it. It was,
I promise I'm going to segue into your book, but this is the segue. So the Wonder Years was, I'm thinking 88 to 93, approximately.
Correct. Exactly right. Then.
I did not watch a lot of television, but in years later, I would go back and see things or come up.
Yeah.
And then for this, I went and watched some, and I read a lot about it. And the commercial success and the critical success of that show was extraordinary. And all these big publications and important critics and everyone else declared it one of the most important works in television in ages. Since you created the secret sauce, what was the secret sauce?
First of all, I did not create the secret sauce. The show was created by a couple named Neil Marlins and Carol Black, who created it from the Christmas Story show by Gene Shepherd.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But they left early, very early on. And so I took it over. And there was that sense that we had a mission. Yeah. And the most amazing thing about it were these kids. Fred Savage and these kids probably the most talented actor I've ever worked with. He astonished me week after week, but it really gave me a chance. A lot of it is my childhood. So that's part of the secret sauce is it got me a chance to review a lot of my own childhood growing up in the suburbs and find that particular courage that it takes to be an adolescent. And I think that's really what the show was, is that again, and probably more so even today than it was then, but that kids are brave, kids are heroes, and to survive through everything that adolescence throws at them. And by the way, I'm very happy that there's a new Wonder Years, which I think is going to go on for its second season. I know they were delayed, but I think there's going to be a new season of the Wonder Years, which I think is a wonderful idea to retell this story from a different perspective. So,
Okay. So you're incredibly successful at all these different genres. You're heart and soul of this incredible show, The Wonder Years. And I know they're not completely the same, but I went back and refreshed myself on The Wonder Years. It's this young guy, and he's experiencing love and hope and failure and revenge and envy and all these things. And then I'm reading The Piazza, which is this wonderful, beautiful book. I hope I don't forget to ask you about Scott Howard's illustrations. Right. And I think to myself, okay, there's this kid, Nicola. Well, there's an old man, but then there's Nicola, and he's experiencing all these things that people experience in life in unusual circumstances, a town in Italy in 1933. Were they parallel in your mind as you were working on this book, as you were writing?
No, not at all. Not at all.
There goes my one good theory of the night.
No, I've always been fascinated by magical realism and the fact that small children, because the Kevin, the character in The Wonder Years, is an adolescent. He's a little more, but for small children, truth and magic and illusion are all one thing. They're all part of this zeitgeist of incomprehension that it takes. And so my reason for, in my mind, the storyteller of the book is this boy who's now a very old man. And since all of the landmarks of this town that he lived in have been destroyed, were destroyed by the Second World War, by first the Germans and then the Allies as they came through. So there's nothing to prove that anything that he remembers is true. Yeah. And so he's taking these shards of memory and character and putting them together and trying to sense the magic that he felt at the time.
Yeah.
But the way it came to me was not first by with the child. Niccolo was not the first person who came to me. It was actually Fausto, the fool who sweeps up the thing. And I think for a while I thought it was his story, but these characters, this book was 25 years in the making for me, because the characters kept coming, I didn't know what to do with them. I think probably many authors that go through this, I didn't know what to do with them, but they kept waking me up at night and saying, write your damn book about us.
I want to be in there.
And so I did. So,
okay, I'm going to ask one question and then I'm going to do alphabetical. So Nevin and then Rodney, because I have to stop talking so much. We have so many authors in the show, and some of them, Ken Follett, spreadsheets, Excel spreadsheets, incredibly detailed plans by which he writes his books and keeps track of the character. And then we have the others that we have fondly become known as the pantsers, where they do everything by the seat of their pants. How did these great stories, because they're all connected, they're different stories. Right. You could pick up any chapter of the Piazza and love it and say, that's good. But then they're all connected in a way. Are you a seat of the pantser or are you a spreadsheet kind of guy?
I'm totally pantsing.
Wow.
I'm 100% pants. It's funny because it's not the way that I write screenplays or that I write for television, which has to be organized and structured and highly structured and done in 23 or 30. It's the magic of the fact that these characters appear and define themselves and tell you their story.
Yeah.
You know, it's too simple to say, I just write them down. That's not true. But there is that kind of feeling, that magic feeling.
You just took the word out of my mouth. Nevin, you're next.
I'm a bit of both. I'd like to be more of a pantser, but I find that I need structure in order to be productive. And so I'll give myself a framework and then I'll let myself be a little bit more pantsy once I sit down to write and just see where things take me within the general idea of what I'm working on.
Yeah.
But I'd love to be pure pants, you know, like that, that seems like magic. You're just going, you're sitting down, you don't know what's going to happen. Whoa. Oh my God.
Just don't look down is the answer.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. But then I look down. Yeah.
Look back. Okay. Rodney, in your professional world, I know you need to be more of a spreadsheet kind of guy, but what about your art is your mixology? Is that are you more of a pantsy model?
Wow, that's a good question. Actually, it's funny, Tori. I probably am more spreadsheety in my mixology and more and more pantsy in my professional life. but which is backwards and probably says a lot about my relative, success in the world. But I'm a little both in both situations. I mean, I'm pretty famous. Infamous will be a much better word. Hated would probably be the best word, because in my work situations, I will resort to, okay, Roman one. And this is in the verbal presentation, right? Roman one, Roman two, I think in Roman numerals, because when I was a kid, I was fascinated by the, creating a framework on paper, right? Roman one, then letter A, large A, then number one, then small a. And I tend to convey instructions that way, which means my staff absolutely hate me, because, I mean, they sort of look at each other. Oh, my God, Rodney's he's gotten into the Roman thing again, right?
Yeah.
You know, Roman one, Roman two. But when I have to actually present, say, at a board meeting, I tend to become more pantsy. Yeah. Because, you have to read the room, right?
Yeah, interesting.
If you get too caught up in the Roman numerals when you're doing a presentation sometimes and you're losing the room, you've lost, right? So you got to be able to pivot and be more pantsy. But on the cocktails, I like having a recipe. I like knowing where I'm going, what it's.
Yeah. Yeah. And you understand the chemistry of it.
I think I do. Most of the time I understand the chemistry and the mix, the interaction of different types of, you know, like this cocktail we're drinking tonight has a Italian liqueur called Gran Classico, which is works extremely well with bourbon and rye. Oh, and you have to know why, and that helps it. And so,
okay, I've drained mine. It's called Winter in the Piazza, custom created by Rodney. I'm sorry, 15 seconds, Rodney. Tell us what's in it. It's wonderful. And the flaming of the orange peel is insane.
It is one part rye. It has to be rye, not bourbon, not whiskey. Rye. One part sweet vermouth or Italian vermouth. I use Antiqua Campana, which is my go-to. And the third. Yeah. It's not easy to find, but you can find it around better liquor stores called Gran Classico. That's the Italian liqueur. It's better than Campari, with all due respect to my friend. I just met the North American president of Campari recently. The different
stores. Of course you did.
Of course I did. And but Gran Classico, I love Gran Classico. It's made in Turin. It's now actually made in Switzerland, but it's based on an old Italian recipe. From Turin, and then you flame the orange.
Yeah.
Bingo.
That's great. I think it's the orange that really makes it. And you know, one of our last acts on Twitter is we did post the recipe for winter.
So that means Elon Musk may be enjoying one right now.
Exactly. You know? It can only help.
It can only help.
Exactly. Right. Okay, Bob, back to the piazza. Why Italy? Why 1933? Set the stage for why we are where we are with the piazza.
Well, 1933, because in 1933, we all know what was happening in Germany, but it was happening in Italy as well. Mussolini and the fascists had begun their assault on the real people of Italy, and the black shirts were beginning to appear all over the country, and repression was happening. And this beautiful country, which has its own magic. The Italian, the history of Italy is such a history of conquer and be conquered and hope, despair, dreams shattered. It's part of the language. It's part of the culture. So to do this, I couldn't set this story in Ridgewood, New Jersey, because there's not the same cultural zeitgeist whatsoever. But my fascination here was that all of this beautiful humanity was going to be wiped out by the hard cudgel of fascism and destroyed. And, you know, which has happened God knows how many times in the history of humanity and could happen again. But I thought that it was the most poignant time for to search through the fondest kind of hopes of humanity and the things that if it could happen, it might happen. If a pickpocket could be good enough that he could steal, lift human emotions away, what a triumph. And that was the kind of thought I had about this was that I wanted to tell that. And also the fact that it all, by the end, it's all gone. It's all disappeared.
It's funny. When I first started reading, I thought, okay, why Italy? And then the end of it, and I've been to Italy so many times, and you're right, there's a special magic. And I kind of thought to myself, there's nowhere else. There were so many stories I loved. I'll tell you my favorites, and you have to share one or two of them or whatever. Thanks. Morelli's Horse. Love that.
Absolutely. Number one.
Love that. La Maestra Leonora. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, correct.
Talk about you're going down one path and it takes a turn. Yeah. Holy moly, Batman. And then maybe in honor of the holidays, La Befana. Am I saying that right?
Right. Correct.
OK, that's which correct. One of those three, which is your favorite? Which do you want to share with us?
Well, I think Morelli's Horse, which comes near the very end of the collection. But we have seen Morelli and his horse at various spots through the thing. And Morelli is a vegetable seller who talks to his horse. And at least people believe that he talks to his horse. And because people believe that, we believe that. But my favorite character in the book is the horse, who has the kind of a superior sense of not only where things are going in the world, but how fragile the world is for both people and horses. Yeah. And he is the visionary who has a sense of what how life may go on through courage and everything else. I'll tell you another story that is one of my favorites is the story. It's called The Names of Love. And it's a little 4-page story about two kids who grow up and who fall in love. And because they fall into love, they rename everything as we do when we're young and we fall in love. And it was a story it's about 5 pages long and I wrote it in 45 minutes. And I've never really had that experience before of just boom, the story happened. So
why do you think that happened in your writing? Because you've written a lot in your life of different types. Why do you think that happened?
I don't know. I must be channeling something, hidden, really deeply hidden desire of mine that life would work like that, that life could really work like that. But the other stories you mentioned, La Befana, which is a story about the Italian Christmas, which contained a lot of information I didn't know about Italian Christmases, but again, has that violent kind of, seems to be a story about the magic of Christmas, and then this violence slices through it, and makes it all the more precious for that.
Yeah, another great scene for Fausto.
Yes, another great scene for Fausto.
Fausto was the best. Right. Okay, I have to ask: when you're writing this, and you're coming up with these great characters, do you have visual images in your mind? This is what Fausto would look like, or this is what Dicola would look like, or is it a little blank slate?
No, I do, but I prefer not to put. I prefer not to describe the story because I want the possibly coming from television and film is so visual. It's all about the visual, and I prefer fiction that doesn't tell me what the color of the coat the guy was wearing is. Right. I want to get my own sense of it.
Last week, Claude will remember this. We had on a wonderful author named Neve Vaux. She's an incredible woman. She's written The Chosen, The Beautiful. She has a wonderful little series called Singing Hills. She has another one, The Siren Queen, I believe it is. Phenomenal. Anyway, she was telling us, and the way she described it went completely over my head right away, but she doesn't describe how characters look because she says there's too much obsession with beauty and ugliness and this and that, whatever.
No, that's true.
So essentially the characters speak for themselves and then the reader can come up and his or her. Right. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and I subscribe to that. And actually, because you were going to ask me about Scott Howard and the illustrations. And
Scott is
a dear friend of mine who was a roommate of mine in college and was a banker until he was, through his whole life, but didn't discover that he was an artist until he was 48 years old and has started to do this. And Scott came to me and said, he had read the book, the galley, some of the stories, and said, I'd love to illustrate this. And I said, well, you can illustrate it, but you can't show what anybody looks like. And we had some, there are a couple that I gave in on, but we continued to have pitched battles about showing what people look like.
The last illustration, the young soldier from the back.
Right, from the back.
The illustrations are beautiful, could almost stand on their own, and only an indie publisher would let you put illustrations through.
That's correct.
Only an indie publisher. Which is so great. They're beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Okay, I've got to get you out with something here. It's two-part.
I can stay.
Writing for television versus writing a book like this. What's the process like for you? Because in television, again, I know nothing, but I'm making this up. In television, I got to believe there's such a limited amount of time, and you have to have certain arcs, and you have to have this and that, whatever.
Absolutely.
So it seems to me very restricted.
It is. It's very structured, very restricted. And also you're constantly, especially if you're a producer, you're constantly aware of what it's going to cost to do this and how you're going to shoot it and what's it going to look like. And everything has to be structured in that way. So the words in television are far less important than the visuals. Whereas in fiction, it's all happening through the words and through the music of the language.
Yeah.
So they're very different skills. So
you've mastered them all. Nevin, Rodney, questions for this wonderful guy, this wonderful author? Neil?
What's next? What are you working on now? You seem to, have so many talents. I wonder where you're applying them.
I actually have two novels that I'm sure I'll never finish. They seem to be so big, but I'll just give you this and you can puzzle over this. I was walking through the Luxembourg Gardens couple of years ago with my wife, and I spotted this broken beaked old crow sitting on top of the statue, I think of Baudelaire or somebody else. And I immediately decided that he is actually the incarnation of a brilliant 19th century Belle Epoque painter, oil painter, who has squandered his talents and therefore been cursed to spend the next century or so in various incarnations while he figures out what he did wrong. That's my new novel. It's called Corbeau, and I'm working on it now.
Awesome.
Very cool. I have one other question, which is, out of curiosity, what's your writing regimen? I'm always interested most productive and how long.
Yeah, it's so important and it's so hard to do. My writing regimen is 9 a.m. If I can make it to noon, I've been a good boy.
Yeah.
And I don't have to hang my head for the rest of the day, because it's really hard. And it is the key, I think, to writing, is to get your ass in the chair and do it.
Bob, my question is sort of a big thought question, and that is I was, and for the record, I haven't finished because I was in Vietnam when I was told I was going to be on the show. So I read what I could read in the free Kindle download on my phone. But I'm now the book's coming, supposed to be here tomorrow. I mean, I've read about half of it, which I love. I love this book.
And Rodney, your beautiful Italian wife would love it as well.
Indeed, my Italian citizen wife and my Italian citizen children would love it.
Right.
There seems to be a character, sort of a ex machina character, Mussolini, right? In the part I've read, he's like a character in the book, but he never appears. He's not like a real character. And funny story is, my wife's grandmother at her bedside table had three portraits. She had a portrait of the Pope, John F. Kennedy, and Benito Mussolini. And growing up, Maria, my wife, and her sisters thought that Mussolini was their grandfather or their great-grandfather. Seriously, true story.
Wow.
Like, you know, there's Grandfather Benito or whatever.
Missing story from my book. I need to plagiarize it now.
Yeah.
I need to go back.
Go ahead. It's yours. Yes. Jesus Christ, John F. Kennedy, and Benito Mussolini. He made the trains run on time. Literally say that. You know, it's crazy. But when you were writing the book, tell me a little bit about how you sort of tried to convey that this is the ultimate sort of conundrum, or if that's not the right word, it's an oxymoron. This beautiful country with these beautiful people and spiritual people, and yet looming in the background was this monster, you know, Mussolini, that came as close as any human could come to ending that paradise, How did you work that as you arrived?
But I tried to see it through the Italian ability to see horror with a sense of humor. And mostly when I talk about Mussolini, it's with this kind of almost degrading kind of condescension that I think that is the only defense against a monster who can't be stopped, because the Italians have seen it again and again. So, and I think it's something in this country that we're probably concerned about as well, from time to time. And so the idea, I think for the Italians, the idea is to glorify his silliness in a way, knowing that deep down it's terrifying. I tried to give that sense of it.
Yeah.
It was just this. I found myself reading each chapter, each story, going, okay, this is wonderful. It's great. Even when it was sad, okay, this is wonderful. And then there's this cloud that just goes all the way through. Always. And it, again, brilliant writing, Bob. It becomes this impending, growing sense of doom over the whole thing. You know, somebody could diagram these sentences and probably figure it out, but I just thought it was sheer genius. It's fabulous. Everyone should go to their favorite independent bookstore or bookshop.org and get the Piazza. Stories from Piazza Santa Caterina Piccola. Why that location? That's a real place, isn't it?
No.
Oh, I think totally. It is. I think
it may. It, well, you know, the odds are there probably is one like that somewhere in Italy.
Okay. Well, it's beautiful, and I hope
I haven't heard from their attorneys anyway. At this
now that you've said it on this show, expect a call.
Or you just pay the highest compliment an author can get. It's a real place, right?
That's a real place.
Right. Yeah, it's a real.
That's place. A lovely thing. Thank you.
Yeah.
I love to hear this, and I'm glad that it's reached you.
Hey Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
All right. I have to do a little bit of housekeeping, and then we'll get out and thank everybody. So, Claude, I've got to talk about Rob Dundon, right?
Yes.
Rob Dundon is a wonderful person. He is a Tony Kornheiser, a longtime little. He's one of the original fans of the show. We love him to death. And a couple of years ago, his mom, Kathy, died a few years ago of Alzheimer's. And Rob has become one of the most devoted fundraisers for Alzheimer's research out there. And one of the things he does, if you go to the Alzheimer's website, ALZ.org, you know, go to Kathy's legacy, you'll see he asks people to contribute. And if you contribute as little as $25, you can get one of the books that he has gotten from mostly Chatter on Books authors. They have contributed books to this cause, but often others. And he sent us an update recently, pretty amazing. So he got Hugh Bonneville from Downton Abbey, rock star, has not been on the show, but we'll take him anytime. Sent a copy of his memoir, and he sent a note to Rob saying, "Hi, Robert, here's a copy of my book for your fundraiser. I'm fully committed to charitable causes here in the UK, so won't be in a position to collaborate further, but I wish you every success. Kind regards, Hugh Bonneville." Which I think is spectacular. Nevin, I think he got a book from you, which is fabulous. Mike Crowley, Alan Zweibel. Did you ever run into Alan Zweibel, Bob, in your career?
I did.
Yeah, fabulous guy.
Nice guy.
Nice guy. Great guest. Brendan Slocum, all sorts of people. So I failed. I was supposed to talk about this weeks ago. I didn't, but now I'm talking about it. If you go to ALZ.org and Kathy's Legacy 2022. There's still time to contribute. It's a wonderful cause. Rob, we love you. We appreciate what you're doing. And thank you so much. So I want to thank Claude for making everything happen. Nevin, I would love to see you more than once a year, my friend. Oh,
I love seeing you, Tori. I'll take whatever time I can get.
There we go. Rodney, best to the family. By the way, Rodney's sister and wife and her sister are very good friends of mine. And the grandmother also taught them how to put hexes on people.
Yes.
Legit good hexes.
Life skill. Good life skill. Yeah.
Maloika? Yeah. Is that what it's called, right?
Maloika. A Maloika. Don't push us. Don't get on our wrong side.
I know people whose lives were changed and not for the better because they had hexes put on them by the Bolleswomen. We are off next week, and then we're back in December, and I'm very excited about this with Andrew Sean Greer, who is a novelist several times over. Yeah, Nevin's eyes get big.
I'll be listening to that episode.
Pulitzer Prize winner for Lost and Less, and now he has Less is Lost, which is a fantastic book. So we will look forward to that. Everybody, thank you. Stay well. Have a terrific Thanksgiving, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.